You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, August 10th, 2023, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
So, a few things going on here. First, as you could probably tell, I am sick. I have an upper respiratory infection. I'm ill. I know, it sucks.
Do you feel really sick, Steve, or you just
I do.
Sick?
Yeah, it's one of those, it's like the worst day of a cold, you know, where you have the achiness everywhere and a fever and the nose is running like a faucet.
I remember those days.
Tested negative for COVID. It doesn't really feel like COVID. You know, it feels more like a summer enterovirus, which is, I think, what it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, we just like a few weeks ago stopped wearing mandatory masks in the hospital, and this is how long it took me to get sick. I haven't had a cold in 3 years, whatever. 2 weeks after no mask policy, I get a cold.
I mean, does that mean you were primed to get it in a sense?
No.
Or conditioned?
No, I just had people. I had patients with runny noses sitting in front of me without wearing a mask. That's what it means.
Yeah, it just means sick people are sick. It's like teachers.
People don't feel
it's
obliged
like the minute
to wear
teachers
a mask,
went back with that mask.
So I tested negative for COVID. I did wear a mask all day. We'll see what happens tomorrow.
Yeah, I do that whenever I have just the slightest weirdness at work. Is I'll wear an N95 for a few days just to be safe. Because you're in really close quarters. Like when I'm doing therapy, it's like closed door, tiny room, one on one for an hour. Mm-hmm. You know, like we're gonna catch whatever anybody has if they have.
You're
something.
Exchanging your microbiota.
Yeah. Oh yes.
Steve, slice a red onion and put it in a stocking and wear it to bed tonight.
Okay, sounds good.
All right.
Thank you, Pastor Evan. tomorrow is Jay's birthday.
Happy birthday, Jay.
You. I made it.
You made it, yep.
He made it.
Again.
One more circuit around the sun.
Yep.
It's good to make it.
And Monday, Kara, something's happening.
Monday.
Something's happening in Kara world on Monday, I think.
Something's happening in Kara world.
Sleep in that day. Take it easy.
Yeah. Turn your alarm off.
Monday, I am defending my dissertation.
Whoa.
Oh, my gosh.
Can you believe?
Now,
I can.
Do you think everybody out there in podcast land knows what that means?
I think they do generically.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have a perception.
Yeah.
All right, Evan, what do you think it means?
You basically wrote a book and you have to get up and orally defend it against a panel, effectively, of people from your field.
Oh, okay.
Not bad.
All right.
What about you, Jay?
It's a great question because I was going to ask you to clarify that a little bit. From what I understand, you know, they read your dissertation and then they're going to basically shoot holes in it. And you have to sit there and explain to them like everything. And their job is to kind of make it difficult for you to you're not just going in saying, yeah, I wrote this. Like they're going to be like, what does this mean? Explain this in detail. How do you correlate these two things together? All, you know, questions like that make you have to really explain your position.
Yep.
That's close enough, Kara, to give us a technical definition.
I don't know. So different schools do it differently. My school calls it the FOR, the final oral review. And, you know, that is in essence their dissertation defense. Some schools call it a thesis.
Mm-hmm.
Some schools call it a dissertation. My hunch is that thesis is British and dissertation is American.
I also thought thesis was master's and dissertation was PhD.
I did too, but my multiple dear friends of mine went to Caltech and they had a doctoral thesis at Caltech. But I think that's Caltech being like, we're like the Brits.
Okay.
I really do.
Ah.
So I'm not sure. I think in some respects they're interchangeable. But yes, when I did my master's degree, I defended a master's thesis. Now I am defending a doctoral dissertation. And when it's published, you know, in the in ProQuest or whatever publishing platform they use, it is called a dissertation. But sometimes they're called theses.
So a quick definition that I find is that a thesis, I think, is the more general term for defending your area of knowledge in a graduate program, while dissertation is specific to a PhD.
That's so weird that some PhDs still use the word thesis.
Anyway,
so yeah, it's all... Yeah, it's all language. So
micrometer.
Exactly. Yeah. That was fun. So basically, I wrote this, you put it well, Evan, book. Mine's actually not that long, if I'm being 100% honest.
Oh, it's a novella then.
hi-yo. It is, well, it's long enough that when I first opened the document, I don't know how many pages it is because Microsoft Word has to like
takes
catch
time.
Up. Yeah, so.
Oh, well, then it's long
enough. Yeah, give me a minute and I'll tell you. Okay, it's speeding up now. It is 185 pages.
Yeah.
But
a word.
We have to remember that includes like appendices and references and everything.
So which is work. It's not like that's not work. Like the appendices and everything is like a huge part of the work. Your literature.
Yeah,
it's
true. Yeah. So basically you write this thing, and the way that my university does it, and I think that this has become more common practice, to be honest, which is why I'm not overly stressed about this. Maybe I should be. is that you have a committee, and your committee is made up of different people. Different committees have different compositions. My school requires a committee of at least four. So I have a committee chair. I have a second reader who's on faculty. I have a third reader who's on faculty, and that individual is also a methodology expert. So, you know, with psychology research, they can be quantitative or qualitative. And so you need a different type of methodology expert for different types of dissertations. And then you have what's called an external reader, and that's pretty common. So that's somebody from another university who's unbiased, who had nothing to do with your work, who sits on your committee, and they're expected to be a subject matter expert. So I was lucky enough to get somebody who's like a really big deal in the field of gerontology and who's published on end-of-life stuff before. So that's really great. And then you all convene, and basically I take, you know, 45 minutes, an hour to present my work, make a PowerPoint, go through it, show the lit review, show the research that I did, show the results, show the discussion, the limitations, all that kind of stuff. And then, yes, they ask you specific questions. Why did you choose to do this? Why didn't you do it this way? If you could do it all over again, what might you change? You know, what were some of the things you had control over? What were some things you didn't have control over? Then they usually close the door and go rubble, 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 and, you know, discuss amongst themselves and bring you back in. And then from what I hear, it's always, congratulations, doctor. Maybe not always, though, because some people don't pass, which to me blows my mind.
So having watched this, my wife go through this process, so I had a very, basically front row seats, even though I wasn't doing it myself.
Did you go, though? Did you attend her?
No, I couldn't do it.
Oh, but, you didn't.
But... she has a thesis advisor, right? And it's interesting, a thesis advisor who, you know, made sure she passed. You know what I mean? Like, their job is to usher you through that process. So
they should not get you to this point. They shouldn't be like, sure, we're ready for the defense if your paper
if you're
is not.
Yeah, they fail.
Publishable.
Like, if you fail your dissertation, that means they failed because they were supposed to get you to the point where you were ready. You know, it was
and this should be publishable quality. Publishable. Like, this should be, 100%. It should be contributing to the field. It should be contributing to the state of the literature. And so I've already gotten really beautiful and lovely feedback from everybody on my committee, which is really nice.
Yeah.
My dissertation went through a few different rounds of edits, but the overwhelming feedback was just really positive and really supportive. And so I'm excited about that.
Yeah. So now, is this more of an exercise or is what's the...
Yes and no.
What's the net positive coming away from having to orally...
Well, so there's a couple different things that can happen. For some people, it's the first time everybody is in a room together. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, things come up that didn't come up before. Because each of your committee members should have read it and given you feedback individually. But now you've got a group of colleagues that are sitting down going, oh, yeah, maybe if this, maybe if that, what about that? So it is important to some extent that you're all together and having a discussion. And also, your paper doesn't have to be locked in by the time you defend it. Mine is as close as I can possibly get it. But things will come up during the defense that I can then further dial in.
Before you submit it for actual publication.
For proofreading. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So like they call it the final draft at my university, at least they have to approve my final draft before we can even schedule the defense. But the final draft is not actually final. Mm-hmm. It's like VF.1, you know?
Yeah.
So if anything comes up during the defense that they want me to tweak or that we all agree would make the most sense to tweak, I can still do that before I submit it to proofreading.
Yeah. It's like peer review in a way.
How often do people actually, like, legit fail this process?
I don't think it happens often at all, but I'm sure it does happen. And I'm sure that when people do fail, like Steve, you were saying, it's a failure of the committee. It's also probably, I would assume, has more to do with personality problems, yeah, with like people being like, well, no, I'm just going to push forward anyway. Like just like not listening to the advice that they're given.
Again, from watching the process, mm-hmm, my sense is that you don't fail like at your defense. The defense is right, kind of the formality cap at the end. Mm-hmm. But with people who fail to get their PhD, they never get to defend it because they didn't get to that point. They never finished their project or their research, never whatever. They never got to the point where their advisor said, yes, you're ready to defend, you know.
Yeah. And I think for me, you know, what I find is really interesting is among a lot of my colleagues who are significantly younger, right, because I'm doing this later in life, this part stresses them out to no end because I think a lot of people have a fear of public speaking.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they have a fear of feeling, how do I feel confident about my work? And it's so funny to me because this part's the easy part for me. Like I did the hard work already. Well, like anything they ask me, I know the answer to because it's my research.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like I did it. I wrote the damn thing. And so for me, and also I'm a professional science communicator. Yeah. Like I do this for a living.
Yeah, I can't undersell that.
100%. So even though there's like people are like, oh, it's the defense. It's so stressful. It's so stressful. I'm like, no. The stressful part was writing the damn thing. Like I'm good to go now. Yeah, yeah. So I'm excited.
Hundreds of hours of work that got you to this
point. Yeah, seriously. I'm excited to have this behind me because it's just one more checkbox. So once I finish this on Monday, I have 2 more weeks of seeing patients, and then I have 1 week of paperwork, and then I'm done with my internship, which is the last requirement to earn a PhD in clinical psychology.
And you get awarded the PhD on a specific date that you know yet, or no?
The way that they do it is it's not about graduation day. They award it to you the last day of your internship if everything else is submitted.
Got it. Yeah.
Which will be
for you, right?
It will be for me. Yeah. I shouldn't have any, you know, I shouldn't have so many changes that it doesn't take a few days before I push it through to the publisher. So, or the proofreader. So for me, yeah, I'm lucky. Like a lot of my colleagues are in a really weird boat where our internship ends on August 31st and they have postdocs starting September 1st. So they had to take their vacation the last 2 weeks. They had to save it all year, take it the last 2 weeks, and everything has to be backdated for early because you can't start a postdoc if you don't technically have a PhD.
Yeah.
Like they will not let you be a postdoc if you don't have a doctorate. So they had to do some like weird maneuvering in order to make that work. But I'm lucky. I don't start until January for my postdoc. I get to take time off.
That's
and
nice. Yeah.
Chillax. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, congratulations. We'll keep us updated for this last few weeks of the process. And then
we'll do.
Yeah. All right. Evan, you're going to start us off with a special report. This is a 5 to 10 year follow-up on the Loch Ness Monster.
Yes, yeah. Every now and again, we like to revisit news items to see how a particular subject has come along in the last 5 to 10 years, as we like to say. For example, Bob, invisible cloaks are 5 to 10 years away,
oh my
right?
God. Well, what wavelength are you talking about? Visible? No. <Nope.
laughs> How about this one, Jay? Everyone will be walking around with their personal droid or robot in 5 to 10 years. That's something we actually talked about years
ago.
That
can't come fast enough.
No kidding. And you're right. And here we are, and it really hasn't happened yet. Kara, 5 to 10 years, CRISPR technology will grow by leaps and bounds.
Well.
Yeah.
Applications, for sure. Yeah.
Absolutely. This is why it's good to take a look back every now and again when we talk about things. Oh, 5 to 10 years from now, let's see exactly where we went. Sometimes, yeah, things have progressed, and other times, no, pie in the sky. So it just so happens it was 5 years ago when I reported on the latest attempts of researchers to find hard evidence of the Loch Ness Monster. Here's a very, very quick reminder for you. It's Scottish folklore. The Loch Ness Monster, Nessie, which is sometimes called by, it's a creature said to inhabit Loch Ness in the Scottish Highlands. It's often described as large in size with a long neck and one or more humps protruding from the water. The size of the creature varies. Their descriptions over the years have ranged everything from 6 meters in length to 17 meters in length. By all accounts, it's unusually large, especially for a creature in that particular body of water. Now, many had believed that the creature could be a plesiosaur.
Yeah. Hmm.
large aquatic-faring animals, which arose from the time of the early Jurassic epoch, about 175 million years ago. But legend of this particular beast rose 90 years ago, and thanks to the media of the day, offering vivid accounts of people describing what they saw as a sea serpent or a dragon. Mm-hmm, plus a change, right? But the bottom line is that 90 years of evidence of Nessie's existence is entirely anecdotal. There have been a few disputed photographs and sonar readings thrown into the mix over the years. However, nothing concrete. Well, just 5 years ago, and perhaps you remember this news story when I presented it, a global team of scientists scoured the icy depths of Loch Ness using environmental DNA equipment in an experiment that hopefully would discover if Scotland's fabled monster really does or did once exist. Now, environmental DNA, it's a surveillance tool that's used to monitor for the genetic presence of an aquatic species. For example, here in the United States, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they're using eDNA, as they call it, to monitor for the genetic presence of bighead carp and silver carp, which are two species of Asian carp, and they are invasive. So it's good to know if these invasive species are, in fact, getting into our fresh waters. Whenever a creature moves through their environment, they leave behind tiny fragments of DNA, skin to scales, feather to fur, feces to urine, slime to scum, secretions and emissions, the likes of which you probably don't want to know about. However, this DNA can be captured, sequenced, and then used to identify that creature by comparing the sequence obtained to large databases of known genetic sequences from hundreds of thousands of different organisms. That's quite a data bank. So this is what the researchers had done. They took 250 samples of water taken around the lake, from the center of the lake, and the very depths of the lake. These DNA samples were captured, extracted, sequenced, and then compared against global DNA databases to reveal a comprehensive picture of what life has been in Loch Ness, all the way down to bacteria, fish, everything in between. So bacteria to fish and all manner of creature and everything else you can think of. And here were the results. They can't find any evidence of a creature that's remotely related to a Loch Ness monster, a plesiosaur, or anything else within those sequence data samples. So, no, the plesiosaur idea did not hold up based on the data that was obtained. One thing they did find was a good amount of eel DNA, so they said, well, maybe it's plausible that you've got some kind of giant eel in this lock, but...
That's not plausible.
The eDNA doesn't speak to the size specifically of the creature, but the eel DNA, right? But other than that, you can basically rule it out. But the next big hubbub on the heels of that research was another study showing that plesiosaurs had lived in fresh water. That was new information. Now, this was an oops kind of moment because some very intelligent person over at the University of Bath thought it was a good idea to contaminate their scientific findings with a throwaway comment on how plesiosaur in Loch Ness, it being a freshwater lake, is, and I quote, on one level, plausible. Oh my gosh, that was a feather in the cap of Nessie believers everywhere. If you go back and look for the headlines for that science news item, it was almost universally, they all said, scientists say Loch Ness Monster plausible. And yeah, of course. That was the end of that. But did the science really finally break in the direction of the true believers? No, because there was a major problem. You see, Loch Ness is only, 10,000 years old? And the plesiosaurs went extinct well before Loch Ness was formed. So 66 million years, at the same time of the dinosaurs, they were gone.
But they say, Evan, that there were connections between Loch Ness and the ocean or whatever. But of course, if there's salt, that's a saltwater and a freshwater body of water. So usually people, even though it's not a fish, usually animals don't live in both. But so do you guys remember when we were in Scotland?
And we were
visiting the Highlands.
Yes.
And our tour guide, who was a local Scot, very awesome tour guide, she asked us where we wanted to go. And we said, take us to the most beautiful loch in the area. And she was like, thank goodness you didn't ask me to take you to Loch Ness.
Oh, yeah.
We're like, yeah, we're good. We're good on that.
I remember that. Yeah, she was like, do you guys want to go to Loch Ness? And we were like, I don't think you know who you've got in your bus right now. And then we had lots of long conversations.
I mean, if it was nearby, I would have been like, sure, I don't mind.
No, but it was super far.
Take a look, but like,
yeah. No, it was.
It was far. It was way out of the way.
It would have tacked on an entire half, extra half day.
You would have missed a whole bunch of stuff for that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
that's why she was
exactly.
Like. But she must get that request a lot and have to like reorganize the day and miss all the cool stuff just so people could see the Loch Ness, you know.
And it's probably so frustrating because I'm sure, I mean, we haven't been, but I'm sure that the Loch Ness is really beautiful, but it's also become this like tourist trap.
Yes, and that's the point, Kara, because here we are 5 years later, okay? And this is despite that scientific evidence continuing to pile up that there's no Loch Ness monster. It doesn't dissuade true believers. No. You see, the irony of Loch
– the ETNA thing is like that's the last nail in the coffin.
I mean, pretty much, really. I mean, where else are you going to go from there as far as being able to come up with something tangible?
But, Evan, really, they have really blurry sonographic images, you know, of the bottom of the lock. You know, it's
just, and stories about people seeing it.
Somebody's third all kinds of descriptions. Brother said that they saw it once.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. But no. No amount of evidence will stop people believing, you know, about fantastical and mythological creatures. So because, look, listen to this, guys. A few days ago, here we are, 5 years later from that, okay? Here's where we've come to. Media around the world, I don't know if you guys saw this, almost simultaneously, my news feed practically blew up with this one. BBC, ABC, AP, CBC, CBS, Washington Post, New York Post, Fox, NPR, and let's not forget TMZ.
It's a lot of initials.
All of them, I mean, really, in concert, in near-perfect synchrony, they reported, this was this past weekend, August 26th and August 27th of this year, so a couple weeks coming up, a new search for Nessie will take place, reportedly the largest search in the last 50 years. Okay, well, is it another scientific search, such as the one for the eDNA back in 2018? Oh, no. Is it a concentrated effort by paleontologists to search for the plesiosaur, maybe specifically for plesiosaur? No, it's not that either. It's a promotional event organized by the Loch Ness Center in Drumadroit, sorry, I pronounced that incorrectly, I'm sure, and looking for a volunteer research. Oh, and a volunteer research team called the Loch Ness Exploration Society, apparently. So, yeah, not a scientific one. But simply, as you were saying, Kara, tourist trap stuff. Mm-hmm. People, you know, the local economy basically has promoted this thing to get people to come and participate in this latest, greatest search. Here you go. But all of them quoted the event organizers here. Are you fascinated by the legendary tales of Nessie and the elusive Loch Ness Monster?
No.
Do you have a passion for unraveling mysteries and exploring the extraordinary? Join us as a monster hunter volunteer in this exciting quest, the biggest search for the Loch Ness Monster in 50 years. It's our hope to inspire a new generation of Loch Ness enthusiasts by joining this large-scale surface watch. You will have a real opportunity to personally contribute towards this fascinating mystery that has captivated so many people from around the world.
It's so sad because I feel like when it comes to this kind of stuff, like you remember the, what were they called? The horse heads? The Cupies?
Yes, the, it began with the K, Cali.
The Cupies? Cowpies?
The Selkies?
Oh, the those enormous metal structures, the horses' heads.
Oh my God, Scottish people listening right now are screaming the answer to us. Kelpies.
Yes.
The Kelpies, yes. Like there, you know, there was like ancient mythology that was tied to them. And the history of that ancient mythology is fascinating and beautiful. And you can talk about it in that way. And it can be something that's an interesting piece of history. You don't have to like feed into being like, and it's real.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Oh, my
gosh.
That's
the annoying part.
Oh, it's the immediate can't resist things about it.
You know, UFOs, Bigfoot, you know, they will always. They know it's BS. They don't care. They just know that this is.
If
you can squeeze that into a headline, you're golden. That's it.
That's it.
And how stupid do they feel though? Like these like serious journalists when they have to write something like that.
Oh my gosh, I don't know. Maybe they give it to people who you know
they give the it to
lower
the intern.
Desks or something. Yeah. My gosh. I mean, but again, you know, I don't think we have to drudge on about all the evidence that's piled up over the years suggesting there is no Loch Ness Monster and the eDNA kind of cap that, as Steve said. But here we are. Here's where we've come in the last 5 years. Legitimate scientific inquiry and research using eDNA techniques 5 years ago all the way down to calling all believers cry from the local economic concerns in order to drum up more interest and future interest in the search for the best known creature in cryptic history. And sometimes, hey, things evolve and get better over the course of 5 to 10 years. And sometimes in that same time span, things devolve into further depths of nonsense and pseudoscience. This is a case of the latter.
Well, give us an update in another 10 years, Evan. We'll see.
Absolutely. Or in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
When they, we saw the Loch Ness Monster. We got photos and things. And
yeah.
But I got drunk and I saw something.
All right. No. Thanks, Evan. Kara, yeah. I understand that depression does not cause cancer.
Who would have thunk?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, you know, that shaman, whatever that guy name is, from Goop, you know, who says that children, sad children, is the reason why some children get cancer.
Oh, my God. Gosh. Are you serious?
Yes. Shaman Druman drew him.
Oh, that's horrible. Well,
he's horrible.
Luckily, that is not what this study is trying to debunk, is that ridiculous claim. But I can attest firsthand as an individual who does psychotherapy with people with cancer, that there is a lot of concern about outlook, about attitude, and about the potential negative consequences of clinical depression and clinical anxiety and its effects on cancer. And there has long been, even within the cancer community, a hypothesis that there is some sort of correlation between mental illness and cancer, specifically depression and anxiety. They've been thought in the past to increase a person's risk of developing cancer, but some studies have shown correlations and other studies have been inconclusive. And so a new study that was just published in the journal Cancer, which is the American Cancer Society's journal of record, is called Depression, Anxiety, and the Risk of Cancer, an Individual Participant Data Meta-Analysis. So they used an approach called IPD, Individual Patient Data or Participant Data Meta-Analysis. It's a specific type of meta-analysis in which, you know, we've talked about meta-analyses on the show before, right? Do we need a refresher on that? Okay. So it's a specific type of meta-analysis, meta being, you know, larger, like overseeing, right? So a meta-analysis combines the results from multiple studies, and then those results are kind of analyzed so that we can make larger inferences about data. What an IPD meta-analysis does, which is really interesting, is instead of looking at the publications and extracting data from those publications, they actually go back to the original source, the researchers who first published, and they get source data, put it all together, and then reanalyze it. So it's a ton of work, but it's a really important approach to trying to understand large quantities of data. We're looking at an N of 319,613 individuals. We're looking at 25,803 incidences of cancer and 3,254,714 what they call person years of follow-up. There's a lot of data in this study. And they looked to see if there were any relationships, associations between depression, anxiety, and the incidence of various different types of cancer. And here's what they found. There was no association between depression or anxiety and overall cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, colorectal cancer, or alcohol-related cancers. They did see an association in the incidence of depression and anxiety with, Steve, you can't guess because you probably already read it, anybody else? What kind of cancer do you think they might have seen an association with?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question.
Think of cancers that are often associated with lifestyle. Not always, but often.
Hmm. Stomach cancer?
Oh, lung cancer?
Lung cancer.
Really?
Lung cancer. So they did see an association between the incidence of lung cancer and smoking-related cancers. But when they changed their analysis to adjust for those risk factors like smoking, alcohol abuse, and things of that nature, that attenuated the results significantly. And it could be that there's still some variables within there that they're not accounting for. So pretty much the outcome here is that depression and anxiety are probably linked in a very complicated way to cancers that are related to smoking, because again, you know, when we're looking at these linkages, this is not a causation scenario, right? This is correlative. So are we talking about people who are more likely to smoke are more likely to develop depression or anxiety and are more likely then to get lung cancer? Is it that people with depression and anxiety might be more likely to smoke and then get lung cancer? What is that complex relationship? Likely these are covariates there, but we don't see that overall cancer or any of these other specific cancers. And interestingly, alcohol-related cancers, there's no relationship there. So, you know, part of why I think that this study is, A, important is because in some ways it sort of puts to bed the mythology that can sadly lead to what you mentioned, Evan, a sort of blaming the victim mentality and the opportunity for rampant pseudoscience. But also I think from a mental health perspective, this is just a little bit more evidence that is helpful. You know, I think about this personally when I'm working with individuals who are struggling with depression in conjunction or anxiety in conjunction with their cancer diagnosis, which is not uncommon, to take away a little bit of that guilt, shame, and fear that somehow the feelings that they're feeling are going to make them sicker, which is not an uncommon concern.
Yeah, it's a horrible form of blaming the victim.
It is. And, absolutely and horrible. And it didn't help that people could find papers that supported that evidence in, like, mildly supported that evidence. It's nice to have a big study like this that says, look, like, conclusively, we've looked across the board at a lot of studies, and when you reanalyze the data altogether, there's no relationship.
Right. And it's especially bad, as Evan alluded to, when it's like alternative practitioners blaming people, like the direct result of their negative thoughts and attitudes directly causing a cancer, not through a lifestyle mechanism like smoking, but that your sadness gave you cancer.
And, it's,
and so the treatment is to be positive. Like to, it's terrible. It's a horrible
thing. And inauthentic and Pollyanna, which is it causes all sorts of other negative downstream effects. And it's one of the hardest things I find in therapy that we have to work on because there is a strong belief that if I don't keep a positive face, I'm not going to outlive this. I'm not going to be able to fight this. It's going to make me die sooner. It's going to make me die when I wouldn't die otherwise. It's a very, very sad and very, common, type of magical thinking that our society reinforces.
Totally.
And the blaming the victim thing, it's so rampant. So many people that I talk to who are struggling with cancer are asking, what did I do this?
Yeah. Oh,
and
my gosh.
Heartbreaking.
And I know we talked on the show before, too, but just to reinforce it, if like you know someone who has cancer, it's instinctive to want to find something positive to say. And often that translates into, you're strong, I know you can fight this, stay positive. But that's really putting a lot of burden on that person. It's not really helping.
Hugely.
Because the implication is if it doesn't go well, it's because you didn't fight hard enough and you didn't stay positive. It's your fault. As opposed to just saying, I'm here to support you. What do you need? You know?
Yeah. I have, and I can speak very specifically to this because it is, you know, in my dissertation, it will be publishable research. A participant who is a young man who has glioblastoma, and this is, you know, this is a very difficult type of cancer with a poor prognosis. And he has already outlived his original prognostication two times over. He's on borrowed time. And he says that one of the big things that we talked about in the dissertation was that so often people are like, but you'll be the exception to the rule. You're going to be the one who beats this. And he's like, that's not what all my doctors are telling me. And it's really hard because he's had rifts with people that he cares about for that reason. Because it's like that false sense of hope is actually clouding realistic preparations. And I think that there's a way to be hopeful without being Pollyanna, without being inauthentic. And it's such a common struggle for individuals because now all of a sudden, I don't even get to live for myself anymore. I'm having to live to please all of these other people and to make sure that they're not upset by what I'm going through.
Right.
It's such an unfortunate burden.
It's so difficult.
So many people struggle with.
You probably know that we have a close friend, Bruce Press, who died recently of pancreatic cancer. And he, you know, was at the opposite end of the spectrum. Like, he faced it like as a skeptic, as a realist, mm-hmm. as a humanist. And mm-hmm. there was none of that. It was like, yep, I'm going to be dead within 3 months. That's the math. That's the statistics. This is what I'm doing. I have no illusion that I'm going to be the exception. Right? He just faced it totally head on. And yeah. he was kind of awesome about it. You know, he was very inspirational the way he's just like, yeah, this is it. This is what I'm going through, and this is what's going to happen.
And in some ways, I think that he was lucky that he was surrounded by people who were like-minded, because this individual that I was describing in my study also looked at it that way, but the people in his life didn't. And that's where there's so much conflict. That's why it's so important to be aligned with the people, you know, that you care about. It's not an easy thing to do, but it's a tough thing to do.
I'm sure you agree with this. It's also why it's a good idea for people who are very close to somebody who was diagnosed with cancer, could, like, the caregiver or the loved one, whatever, they could benefit from therapy too, because they have to go
100%.
They have to go through
and
a lot of
stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. All right, let's move on. Jay, mm-hmm. Is AI going to stop all these robocalls?
Oh my gosh, please. Please.
Yeah, robocalls suck. I get them every single day. I don't know about you guys, but.
Yeah, I had to change my privacy settings on my phone, so now I don't get real phone calls.
Yeah, I mean, just
it's not worth it.
Right out of the gate, like, the best thing to do, if you don't have the phone number stored in your phone and it's not telling you it's this person, it's that person, like, if you don't recognize the number, you just don't pick it up. Because mm-hmm. if you pick up, you know, an unsolicited call, then they know for certain then that it's a legit phone number, because they're just dialing random numbers until hoping that people pick up. So just don't pick them up.
What if you cancel the call as it's ringing? Does that give them a hint that, oh, that somebody canceled it? Somebody declined the call and it's got it sent to voicemail?
I don't think so.
Or do you let it just ring?
I don't think so. I think you just cancel it. I don't think it's giving them any data. I'm not 100% sure, but I don't think it's giving him. So let me get into this. So scientists have recently developed a robocall monitoring system that they're calling Snorkel, kind of like snorkel.
Snorkel.
Right? And this allows mm-hmm. them to determine what the robocall is about. You know, what data are they trying to collect from the person that's been called? And in half the calls, they can actually figure out who is behind the robocall, and I'll explain to you why that's a really big deal. So how is all this possible? Well, in a recent paper presented at the Senex Security Symposium in Anaheim, California, on the 9th of August, lead author of the paper, Savik Prasad, details a new software platform that seems to be able to put a huge dent in the daily annoying phone calls most of us get. So a robocall, if you don't know, let me just give you the quick 1-2, is when a person is called and there's a recorded message that sounds like a real person's calling. So let me play for you.
Ooh.
I hate these.
This is for science, Kara. We have to suffer.
All right, here it is. Oh, look. Sorry, that's not it.
Oh, see, I would take that call.
Rick rolled right there. Yeah, it was great.
Oh my gosh. I wish that was the robocall.
All right, so here's a couple of samples of robocalls. I'm sure most of you have heard these.
This matter is very serious, emergency, and time sensitive. We are calling you from investigation team of IRS.
Now that one is a low level mm-hmm. one, because they don't even have like a human sounding voice, but people fall for it. People fall for that. You know, like, this robotic voice is basically telling you the IRS, you know, you owe the IRS money, and people respond to that.
They call people like that all the time.
Here's an example. Here's another one. This is what they're more like.
We're BPO. How are you doing today? Glad to hear that. At Delaware BPO, we handle your company's incoming and outgoing.
So, you know, you got this talking voice saying, hi, is this, you know, are you the homeowner? Whatever. Like, they identify you by asking a question that people will answer to. There's just a delay in the recording. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, some robocalls are really sophisticated. Like, I got one where it responds when you respond. So if you say, if it says, how you doing today? And you say, good, thanks. How you doing? It'll respond. because it, you know, it has a limited number of tree branches it can go down to, in depending on what you say. But the point is,
it becomes a choose your own adventure.
Right? And that would be fun. The point is, though, that you know they're trying to engage you. They're trying to hook you. So ultimately, in the engagement with you, they're trying to get information out of you. Sometimes they'll even pivot to a real person once they know that they have a willing mark. You know, if you go down, if you get long enough through the phone call, they'll put a real person on there, and then they'll really start working on you. Mm. So these calls are a really serious problem. Why? Because so many people get them, and a lot of people fall for them. You know, to us, it might seem ridiculous because we're skeptics and we understand, you know, this is nonsense. But to a lot of people out there, especially elderly people, you know, when they hear that they owe money, they get concerned and they want to do something about it. So I found some U.S. statistics. So U.S. consumers received over, get this, 50.3 billion robocalls in 2022.
Wow.
So all of us are getting tons of robocalls, right?
If I had a nickel for every robocall.
A lot of people, sadly, like I said, man, they do fall for this, and people are losing money. And the worst, one of the worst things that can happen to you, and it happens all the time, is identity theft through a robocall. So there's a lot of criminal fraud going on here, and a lot of it is coming from overseas, which make, you know, doing something about it even harder. Telephone companies and government regulators and independent researchers, they historically have only been able to access something called like the metadata of these robocalls. Metadata in this instance is almost nothing. Like they know the number that's being called, right? Your number. They know the number that was being called from, which is the robocall's number, which can be faked. And I'll tell you more about that in a minute. And they know how long the phone call has lasted. It's useless. This is useless information. It doesn't do anybody any good. They can't do – it's not actionable. So that's why we still have these robocalls, because, you know, even if the government passes regulations and stuff, like they can't police it. You know, the current monitoring methods have zero insight into actually what is going on inside the robocall. So again, they can't do much about it. Another major issue with monitoring phone calls, and this is a big one, is privacy, right? You know, we don't want the phone providers to be listening to our phone calls, even if they're trying to help. You know, no, a lot of people out there would freak out if they found out, oh yeah, they're listening to all of our phone calls. A lot of people believe it's happening anyway. But if they're listening or not, they're not doing anything with the information about robocalls. So, but we have to take people's privacy very seriously. So that's a huge factor while trying to solve this problem. And another big problem is the volume of the calls. Like I said before, we're in the billions here. You know, if people were listening to these phone calls, how many employees do you think it would take to listen to 50 billion phone calls? It's right. Physically impossible to police all of this, all this activity. So now this is where this new application called Snorkel comes in. So it's a monitoring system. It listens to phone calls. Now, what the developers of this automated software platform have been able to build, I think it's a really powerful platform, what they achieved here. The system listens to incoming robocalls. Now, what they did was, with the help of a phone company, they created 60,000 phone numbers that are just like everybody else's. You know, these are just regular people-like phone numbers, except they are not people. These are a monitoring system, but they're out there. And these are phone numbers that can be called. These 60,000 phone numbers are what's being used to monitor robocalls. So they're not infringing on anybody's privacy or in any way, because these are just phone numbers that are in a computer system. They're not real people's phone numbers. The Snorkel system, now when an incoming robocall happens, they record it. And then the software analyzes it and it categorizes it. So first, the same exact robocall could come in the system, you know, hundreds of times, right? It might be the same exact one that keeps, you know, getting put out there from the auto dialer that they're using. So what the system first does is it picks all the unique robocalls. So if there's a copy of a robocall, they already process it. It already went through their computer system. They don't need to process it again. And they've saved an order of magnitude of processing power just by, you know, checking to see if they've already done it, which is a pretty simple thing to do nowadays. So once a new robocall comes in, they analyze it with something that they're calling their machine learning framework. It's basically artificial intelligence. The call's content can be completely quantified. And they basically take everything out of this phone call that they can. they'll know exactly what personal information, say, that the robocall is trying to gather. You know, if they mention, you know, we need your social security number, they know that they're harvesting social security numbers. If they mention anything about bank information, then it knows, you know, so it categorizes them on all the different things that they're trying to get out of you inside of this robocall. It also figures out the robocall's scam veneer. Like, what's their scam? What are they actually trying to say to you to convince you to give you the information? Now, a common one here is they could be pretending to be the government or a government agency that says that, you know, you owe money to the IRS, or, you know, they're warning you of late taxes, or it could be, you know, unclaimed vacation awards. I get this freaking robocall all the time. Hey, you have unclaimed vacation rewards. Like, you know, it's the same thing, and it is a pre-recorded thing. It's not even a real person on there. If the robocall asks for money, they'll record that. You know, maybe the call is asking for other personal information that they never even heard of. Well, it can do that too. It can handle basically any scenario that happens inside of that robocall. Now, they tested the system on 232,723 real robocalls that came in over 23 months over the 60,000 phone lines that they created. And they found that there were over 26,000 unique robocall campaigns, right? So it's basically a different robocall. 26,000. That's a huge number. Oh, my God. This is even bigger than I thought. I had no idea. You know.
Yeah, you'd figure it was like the same, I don't know, like 500 over and over.
No, it's just unbelievably huge. The software was able to correctly identify and categorize all the incoming calls, which was great. Now, this is also a huge help for law enforcement, and I'll tell you why. Now, incoming robocalls use something called spoofed phone numbers, and you might recognize this. You get a phone call, and it's like, hey, this phone call is actually in my town. Right. It says, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? Yep.
It can't be a fake.
Yeah. Or, you know, it might say, you know, somewhere in California or somewhere, you know, whatever. So what they're doing is they're using voice over IP technology, right? It's basically a computer is making a phone call using the internet, using an IP address. And without getting into the intricacies of that technology, what it allows them to do, though, is the caller, right, the bad guy, can basically say, hey, whatever phone call you're calling, pick a phone number that is in that same town. And it'll make up a phone number that seems like it's from your town. And it doesn't even have to be a real phone number. It could be the pizza joint down the road. But it also could just be a completely made up non-functioning phone number. But your phone will look at it and go, "Hey, it has my area code. It's from my town, or it's from my area of the state that I live in." So you can't
trust. It's from my work town. That gets me sometimes. Yep. Like, oh, this could be somebody calling from the office.
So what this means, though, is it makes it nearly impossible to track the robocaller, the bad guy, using the incoming phone number, because it's completely worthless information. So the Snorkel software does, however, do something that no other piece of software has ever done in the past. And it's simply, this seems simple, but you got to keep in mind, this is all automated. People don't have to do it. We're using artificial intelligence here to go in and you know, reverse engineer the information that's happening in these phone calls. What they do is at least half of these robocalls have a call to action phone number that they want you to call, right? So if they don't pivot you to another person, and then that scammer starts working on you, they simply ask you to call this number, you know, call this number to redeem your award points or to clear up your, you know, your late IRS bill or whatever. And with that number, and that has to be a real phone number, and it has to go somewhere, you know, it has to actually go to where the scammers are. And with the collection of those phone numbers, now this gives law enforcement the ability to track and actually do something. They could shut down those phone numbers. They could do a lot of different things. I mean, it just depends on the relationship between your country and the country that the phone call is coming from. If they have a good relationship, then, you know, they will be able to handle it, you know, very easily. They could just be feeding them all of these bogus phone, you know, all these bad scam phone numbers that they're trying to get people to call. You can just feed them through the computer system, and they can be automatically shut down. So what this does is essentially speeds up, like, this unbelievably huge number of phone calls. It speeds up the understanding of what's going on in those phone calls and the ability to do something about it. And it might, this might be the thing that, you know, significantly finally lowers these damn robocalls that we're all getting. So I was very excited when I read it because it really seemed like it's obvious. You know, we're using the latest technology, you know, we're using artificial intelligence because, you know, it's very powerful and it's really good at this type of thing. It works very fast and it works without human intervention. There's monitoring, but, you know, it's like there's 500,000 people that are working on it, you know, or the software. Well, the software can do it better. So I think that, you know, we might actually see some changes hopefully in the next year or two once this starts, you know, getting rolled out and used. And finally, you know, law enforcement will do something about all this insane robocalls.
Let's hope. But you know, it's going to be just an arms race, right? But
yeah. I know.
But we got to do it. We got to do it. Otherwise, it's just, they're just going to overwhelm.
Yeah. Then we'll just, we got to at least keep up, you know? You know, but today, like I said, just don't pick up numbers that you don't know. You know, as a consumer protection idea here, it's a really bad idea to pick up unknown phone numbers. Unless, of course, you have a job where you have to always pick up the phone, which a lot of people do.
One thing that might work, I don't know if this exists or not, is like within a corporation, could you whitelist all the phone numbers from within the corporation so that you know this is 100% a work call? Not that it's not a fake call, but that it is a work call, you know?
Yeah, interesting. Like a
whitelist.
Blue check, for lack of a better term, right? It's a confirmed not robocall.
Yeah, I'm in that position. If they do a good job, like it doesn't say this is a possible spam call on my phone, or it has my local area code. It's like this could be work. There's so many numbers at work that it could come from. In the
I know, and those are the ones I sometimes pick those up, and I usually it bites me in the ass.
Yeah, but whatever. If you know, as soon as I detect that it's a sales call or robocall, whatever, I just say no thanks and hang up.
Yeah, but Steve, the thing is though, then they know that a human being picked up the phone and they will call you again with another scam. Yeah. You know, and that's the other thing is like, it's not like one group is using one scam. Like one scam, you know, one scam group could have thousands of scams that they're pushing out on your system, and they just bounce you from one to the next. You know.
All right. Thanks, Jay.
Got it.
All right, guys, let me ask you a question. What do you think? What would you think if I said there could potentially be a way that every single building and house, just in the very construction materials itself, could store enough electricity to run the building for like 1 to 2 days?
So I live in a battery is what you're saying.
Yeah. That's awesome.
That sounds awesome. I say bring it.
I think there are positives and negatives to that.
No negatives.
You're
positive.
Saying the house itself could do it, or that there's a battery integrated somehow into the house?
Well, I'll tell you. But I'm going to ask you a question first, Kara. Can you define for me what a capacitor is?
Yeah, I think so. Okay, so resistors versus capacitors. Okay, resistors are things in a circuit that resist the flow of electricity. Capacitors are things that hold on, like that allow the electricity to kind of bounce back and forth and hold, right?
It holds on to electricity, you're correct.
Yeah,
How does it do that? I know about
this. Ooh, I remember this from my electrophys course.
Yeah, so
it's two plates separated by a membrane.
Yeah, so it's two conductive plates separated by a non-conductive whatever. It could be air.
Right, so it holds it in between there. Okay.
Yeah, medium that's not conductive, right? It's conductor, insulator, conductor. Yeah, the advantage is it charges up really quickly and it discharges very quickly. Disadvantages are it doesn't hold a lot of power and it doesn't hold onto it for long. The power tends to leak. A lot of leakage. I do think that what we're going to see are supercapacitors, which are basically just capacitors with high, you know, density, energy density, that they will start to be incorporated in vehicles, not to replace the battery, but to supplement it, because then you could have your capacitor for regenerative braking, which would be much more efficient. Mm-hmm. But then that power, that energy can go into the battery or just use it to accelerate, you know, and clear it out. Because that's what it's really good for. It doesn't have to hold on to it for long, but it's very good at quickly absorbing the energy, even in cold weather, you know, where battery efficiency starts to go down.
Yeah, but wouldn't that also, Steve, be the dream battery would be a supercapacitor that has the energy density of a conventional battery, but is a supercapacitor? I mean,
the leakage thing is also important. And if it held on to it for a long time, because they do tend to have a very, very many charge-discharge cycles, right? Because it's just a physical substance. Yeah,
it's endless. It's as many as you want, almost.
Supercapacitors are interesting. I mean, we talked in the past about like how good they're getting. A typical like a high energy density supercapacitor, for example, might have an energy density of 16 watt hours per kilogram, whereas like some experimental carbon nanofiber supercapacitors might be up to 73 watt hours per kilogram. And for comparison, a current lithium ion battery is 265, and the Amprius batteries are 500. So it's like almost an order of magnitude. Mm-hmm. Right. And this is more than an order of magnitude from existing supercapacitors, you know. So there's still a long way to go. But we're talking about cars. What if we're talking about buildings? We don't care that much about the energy density or the specific energy. We don't care much about waves. And even to an extent, we don't care how big it has to be. As long as there's enough energy density, you know, that it could be useful. But you could have a massive amount of it if it's like in the building structure. So what do you think would be a good substance, like building substance, to develop into a capacitor?
Something cheap and plentiful.
Yep.
Yeah.
Maybe concrete.
Concrete, yeah, cement. So a study by MIT scientists has done a proof of concept, which means proof of concept means it works in the laboratory at small scale, and don't get excited about this. There's a lot of potential practical issues. This is the whole
too late. I'm already extremely excited.
You said potential.
It is exciting. Just the idea is exciting, but it's
and
like,
it works on a small scale. I mean, why wouldn't this scale up?
There's a lot of reasons why. But anyway, let's talk about what they did.
Those.
Maybe one, not a lot.
Yeah. So they added carbon black to just ordinary cement. So these are two very common substances, right? They're not exotic or expensive. Mm-hmm. And by doing that in a certain way, basically at the nano scale, at the small scale, there's a bunch of little capacitors in there, right? Because you end up having the conducting, the conducting carbon separated by insulating cement, right? The capacitors are all about surface area, right? And so, what they were able to do was cured the cement with the carbon black, they found, and then they examined it at like a microstructure level, they found that the carbon black formed fractal patterns. If you remember what a fractal is, it's like branches on branches on branches on branches, right? So as you zoom in, it still looks the same, you know, like the coastline from space. Like, you know, it has the same kind of rough complexity no matter what level you're at.
Right, or a mountain peak.
Yeah. So that massively increases the surface area, which is what you need to have a high storage capacity, right, for a supercapacitor. So they calculated that with their, you know, again, their laboratory proof of concept cement, that 45 yards of the stuff would be able to hold enough electricity to run a typical American home for 2 days. Like mm-hmm. 1 to 2 days. So it's on the right order of magnitude, right? That's like, you know, 1 to 2 days, running your home for 1 to 2 days, that's the order of magnitude of home backup. It's enough that you could peak shave, right? You could use your solar panels during the day and store that energy to use later that evening. It's enough for, you know, 2 days for a lot of applications. That's all the backup power you need, right? For example, I've been in my house now for about 30 years. One time did we go more than 2 days for a blackout. We had 1 3-day blackout. Other than that, they've all been less than 12 hours, most of them. So 1 to 2 days of backup power would handle most situations. And if you have solar panels, that means your solar panels can continue to work because they have a source of power, which ironically they need to function. So the appeal of this is not that it's like a great supercapacitor. It isn't. It's that basically the world could be built out of this stuff, right?
Oh, my God.
It's that the materials are common. They're already in wide use. They're relatively expensive. This process can be incorporated into the process of making cement fairly easily. So there's a lot of advantages here. But we do need to see how it scales up. We do need to see what happens. Like, how much structural integrity does it lose? You know, does it, remember, cement is a significant source of carbon dioxide release as well. So if we have to like increase the amount of cement that we need to use because we're using weaker cement so that we get the capacitor, you know, function out of it, that we have to calculate what that means as well. But it's just, it's an interesting idea, you know, building stuff out of either a capacitor or a battery.
Man, I would dig a gargantuan pit in my backyard and fill it with concrete so I'd have like 2 weeks, two weeks of house storage.
If it's cheap enough,
right? People will be doing that. Hey, how about this? This occurred to me. Imagine if the Hoover Dam was made of that stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah, let's power like California.
Well, yeah, you could build, you know, wind turbines on top of a massive cement block that then is able to
store the wind energy.
It basically turns an intermittent power source into a pretty reliable one, and like almost a dispatchable, depending on how much, you know, capacity it has. So
this is so cool. You know what it reminds me of, Steve? We talked a couple of years ago about using like manufactured diamond to hold, you know, radioactive material that could actually supply energy for or power for like literally for centuries. Now it's very similar in that it's not very similar to a supercapacitor, but it could basically, if you have a, and it's all size dependent. So if you had like your sub basement filled with this, you could literally power your house.
Yeah, build your house decades, on top of it.
For decades. Which
and
is,
having but, thicker right. cement foundations is not a bad thing, you know. Make them big, twice as big as they need to be, strictly, but just so you have additional energy storage and you get, you know, a more solid foundation out of it to boot.
I'll make my whole house out of it.
And yeah, think about it. Like, would you pay an extra $10,000 or $20,000 on a $200,000 or $300,000 house?
No brainer.
To have this?
No brainer.
Yeah. Sure.
Of course you would.
Yeah, they're saying that it might not even raise the price of just your, for your foundation.
Yeah.
It might not raise it at all. So that make it even more of a no-brainer. This is exciting. This really is something that could make a dramatic change.
I hope it pans out. Again, I'm always skeptical of like the one solution to a complex problem thing. But, you know, I don't see any one thing as a panacea. But this could be one additional, you know, tool in our bag. You know, one additional thing that could, you know, any, because grid storage, grid level storage, or like really dispersed home, residential or commercial storage, really is a game changer for our, you know, ability to turn over into a green energy infrastructure. And you know, there's we've spoken about different options in the past, you know. Raising heavy blocks to, you know, the closed loop hydro, I think is probably the most, the most promising. But this is, this may be one more thing, you know, one more option that has, that works in some contexts. All right, Bob, tell us about the world hiding under the sea.
What? Under the sea. listen, I just saw The Little Mermaid too, so this song is going to
Oh, how can you
head.
Not sing that song?
Right, an international science team has found an unknown ecosystem under the seafloor, underneath another but well-known ecosystem surrounding hydrothermal vents, which spew super hot chemicals and minerals, probably one of the least hospitable environments on the planet. This was a lot of fun. This expedition was led by Dr. Monica Bright from the University of Vienna, along with an international science team from the United States, Germany, Netherlands, France, Costa Rica, and Slovenia. Okay, so to understand this discovery, you need to know about hydrothermal vents. And I'll quote Robin George Andrews from the New York Times describing the vents involved in this discovery. He said, "Off the western shores of Central and South America, there's a Lovecraftian lava-licked realm thousands of feet beneath the ocean. There on the seafloor, volcanically powered exhaust ports, known as hydrothermal vents, fire off jets of water that reach temperatures up to 700 degrees Fahrenheit." I just love that description so much. Lovecraftian lava-licked realm. I mean, the guy is like has such a way with words. I love it. Okay, so we've known about these vents since 1977, which, of course, is the year that Star Wars released, BTW.
Yeah.
But now when they were found near the Galapagos Islands, and they're often near mid-oceanic ridges, which are diverging tectonic plates. If you can imagine tectonic plates like separating from each other, and that creates like a gap, a little bit of a gap as new seafloor is created. So there's volcanic fissures in the seafloor when this happens. And frigid seawater seeps into these fissures and eventually meets the magma, or some people were saying that it even gets to the Earth's mantle, which seemed like quite a journey to me, but that's what they said. Now, this superheated seawater rises back up, and as it does that, it's picking up minerals along the way, and when it rises through the seabed and hits the cold water, then chemical reactions take place, and the minerals that were dissolved in the hot water precipitate out of solution, and they slowly build up, creating these iconic vent chimneys up to 12 meters high. So now this vent water is just stupid hot. I mean, we're talking 400 degrees Celsius, 760 degrees Fahrenheit. That's hot enough to melt lead. But why doesn't it boil? Yes, listener Timmy from Chicago, you're correct. Because of the intense pressure under all that water, it's like an Uber pressure cooker down there. So that's why when they found this diverse ecosystem living down there in the 70s, it was so astonishing. From microbes to tube worms to crabs and more were just living around these vents. But the best part for me, though, wasn't all the life that was down there, but the fact that it was based not on photosynthesis, but chemosynthesis. Extremophile bacteria and archaea, which can survive at 120 degrees Celsius, 248 degrees Fahrenheit, they use chemical energy down there, not photons, to convert carbon dioxide into sugar, which is basically food. Now, they are the base of the food chain down there, like the plants are on the land and the algae and cyanobacteria are in the sunlit parts of the ocean. So these microbes also help larger organisms to survive using symbiosis. For example, tube worms. You may have seen those tube worms. They're red and they kind of poke out of these little tubes. They don't have any mouth or stomach because they don't need them. The microbes essentially say to them, hey, you keep me safe inside and you send me the water chemicals, and I'll make food for you. And sounds like a good gig. Would you do that, Jay?
Sure.
Probably not. I think you like your mouth. The point is that the sun is absolutely irrelevant down there, unlike pretty much all life higher in the ocean and on the land. This could very well be the type of life that first evolved on Earth. And if there's life on Europa and Enceladus, it will almost certainly be chemosynthetic life. It's just fascinating stuff. So this now gets to the new discovery. The marine researchers wondered how the tube worms attach to the rocks when they're really tiny and just floating around. They can't come at it from above because the vents are just way too hot for them to go through that super hot water. So maybe they come from below. So they started thinking that maybe something lives in the under the seafloor that's not just the microbes, because basically before this, we knew that microbes were down there, but we didn't really think anything else was down there. So they took a vessel called Falkor 2 to a spot called the East Pacific Rise off of Central America. And if you remember Falkor, they specifically named it Falkor because of the German fantasy novel, Neverending Story, and a wonderful movie as well. They then went down to the hydrothermal vents, and they used a remotely operated vehicle called, of course, Sub-Bastion, which is also related to the book, right? It had manipulators that actually lifted a chunk of the seafloor up near a vent, and they saw, what did they see? They saw an underground labyrinth. Ooh. A network of caves and tiny passages filled, of course, with life all over the place. And not only that, but the seawater in these labyrinths were 25 degrees C, 77 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's kind of ideal for a backyard pool. It's also ideal for microorganisms and larger creatures like snails and worms down there, which is why they were proliferating. Monica Bright, leader of the expedition and a zoologist at the University of Vienna, said, "We've known about the vents above for a long time, but this is basically a completely new ecosystem below. It's especially strange that we found it in a place that's very well studied." There's still a lot to learn, but one mystery they think this could solve is how those tube worms colonize new vents so fast. Because sometimes you have a vent that's like wiped out by volcanic activity, and all the tube worms and all the other life forms are just wiped out. But then a new one forms even a mile or two or three away, and those tube worms can colonize it within a very brief period of time of just maybe a couple of years. So the researchers think that the tube worms use these passageways to colonize other vents as they form. One researcher even calls them the subsea floor conveyor belt. In the future, I'm sure there will be more expeditions sent to study this new ecosystem to reveal its secrets. One concrete plan that they already have is to genetically sequence the creatures on the vents and below the vents to see if, what the connections that might exist between them to see if these ecosystems are genetically related, which I think they probably are. Wendy Schmidt, president and co-founder of the Schmidt Ocean Institute, who financed this, said, and brings up a very important point, the discoveries made on each Schmidt Ocean Institute expedition reinforce the urgency of fully exploring our oceans so we know what exists in the deep sea. The discovery of new creatures, landscapes, and now an entirely new ecosystem underscores just how much we have yet to discover about our ocean and how important it is to protect what we don't yet know or understand. So that was a very interesting quote. Yeah, very important because, I mean, we could cure diseases with the genetic information that we may find down there. And who knows, what other discoveries are waiting us. And some of the things, throwing plastic in the ocean. And also, these minerals are also, very desirable from mining companies. They just could blindly go in there and start destroying these ecosystems. These beautiful ecosystems and these new ones that we just discovered, just to make a few bucks. So the more we know about it, the more we can do, hopefully, to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that, but it's a little more complicated than that because mining these minerals also is better than what we're currently doing in terms of like the environmental effect and the human cost of like mining cobalt and nickel, et cetera. And also, if this allows us to have our battery-powered future, how much of an effect is that going to have on the environment? And so it's kind of a risk-benefit thing, which is more complicated than that.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully we could find some
compromise.
Somewhere in the middle, some compromise where we don't have to like destroy new ecosystems and especially chemosynthetic ecosystems that really don't exist anywhere else.
Well, yeah, that's like I might offer an alternative explanation of her quote, which is not – we don't know what's down there and we need to know what's down there so we can determine how it can be useful to us and more. We need to know what's down there so we know what we're protecting.
Yeah.
Because of these ecosystems, I mean, I have a feeling that is what she is saying. Like if we are not aware of the rich and complex life, we're going to treat it as if there's nothing to destroy. And that is very dangerous.
Yeah, we have to go in with our eyes open, know what the choices that we're making and the implication of it. And again, hopefully find something like, okay, if we mine it this way, we could be minimally disruptive. And all right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. Kind of weird, huh?
Sounds old to me.
Yes, I'll give you that. That's good.
Yeah, it's got like an analog-y kind of vibe to it.
Is it some kind of animal interacting with some kind of technology?
lots of people wrote in saying that, Steve, in different versions. But all right, so let's get going here. Kyler Dotson wrote in and said, "Hey, Jay, I skipped directly to Who's That Noisy?" Which, if you want to get at the top of the list, that's not a bad idea to do.
I didn't think anybody did that.
He said, so of course, it's one I have no idea what it could be. Anyways, the sound is very similar to the sound effect of Mario getting a coin from the original SNES game.
I love how you guys say Mario. Every time it gets me, because you all say Mario.
I don't know which way to say it correctly.
But the family, I think it's the, I don't know, it's like the Italian novellas. They all say Mario.
So he said, I've been learning and messing with synth sound design lately, and it definitely has the sound of an analog synth or some kind of old audio chip from that era. Hmm. So, okay. Keep that in mind. You landed a little bit in the correct place. I have a listener named Keely Hill wrote into Hi Jay. It's right on the edge between musical and data, like a modem. Sound to me, my guess, someone cycling through the transmission over sound option on a walkie-talkie. And I understand why you picked that, because I've heard those sounds and I know what you're talking about. John Kelly wrote in and said, Hi, Jay, longtime listener and patron, first time contacting you. And then he goes on to talk about his son. So John has a 9-year-old son named Max, and his son Max insisted that his dad submit his guest for this week's Noisy. And he also guessed it's a walkie-talkie. So again, this is not a bad guess because I have heard similar sounds come out of a walkie-talkie, but it is not a walkie-talkie. But good, you know, good job, Max. Guessing. Use that brain. It'll get stronger every time you use it. Will Beldman wrote in, "Hi, Jay. Is this the first game of Pong with sound?" And I was thinking about that, and I'm like, yeah, Pong had some weird blippy noises, right? Super analog-y blippy noises. Not correct, but I like where you were going with that. A listener named Paul Osborne wrote in and said, "Hi, Jay, love your work. I'm hoping you could read my guess, even if I'm wrong, so there's another Aussie name called out besides the famous Visto Tutti." Which, again, there's his name. Mm-hmm. It was said again. Ah, can't get away from him. I think this week's Noisy is one of those vinyl records from the 70s and 80s that had a computer program embedded in them. One example I can think of is from Pete Shelley's 1983 album XL1 that had a track which was actually a program for a ZX Spectrum computer. I included this one because I was surprised that they put, you know, computer programming code onto an album. You know, I guess you play the audio and it hears it and it programs the computer. It's interesting, right? I didn't know that that was actually taking place. So nobody guessed it.
Oh wow.
Nobody guessed it. So let me explain to you what this is here. This is called an optophone. Do you guys know what it is?
Optimophone.
Saxophone.
All right, so
video phone
coming from the person who sent it in. This is from Lucas Snyder, who sent this Noisy in. He said the history of the written language for people who are blind and or visually impaired, and they talk about this optophone, and it's a device that scans letters from a page and converts them into audible tones, so that blind people could essentially read a book. Interesting. There's different versions of the device, but they did make those noises, and those were supposed to be identifiable sounds as you scan over the page, that a blind person can hear and interpret into letters and words. So very interesting. Didn't know that this device existed. I think it's pretty cool. It's an old device.
Yeah, I wonder how much that has fallen out of vogue now that there's text to speech.
Yeah.
And basically the book can just read itself to you as opposed to having that intermediary step. But at the same time, like kind of the self-efficacy of translating it for yourself, I don't know if that's more of a burden or more of a source of importance.
Yeah, I don't know.
So it'd be interesting to speak with somebody and ask them their experience using that versus modern text-to-speech.
While looking up the optophone, I did see a version of it that I think – was making Braille automatically. So you put your finger on the pad, and then as you scan the book, it pushes like pins up into your skin that simulate Braille.
Yeah, to me that makes more sense because then it is the reading that some people know how to do.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Well, I have a new Noisy for you guys this week. This Noisy was sent in by a listener named Chris Irvine, and check it out. Nope, sorry. Sorry, I don't know how that got in there.
You never have to apologize for that noise.
What the heck is going on? All right,
Jay, that's like having a picture of a naked lady in your slide deck.
I know.
It's like a picture of having yourself like flexing in your slide deck.
Oh, who's that handsome?
Oh, that handsome creature.
Yeah. Check it out. It could be so many things.
It's fascinating because those lower tones, I could like feel it in my bones.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep. This one's interesting. I can think of like three things that it could be. I know what it is, of course, but I can think of three things that sound like that. So good luck on this one. I was thinking about maybe giving a hint, and then I decided, nah, I think there's people out there that'll know what that is. So if you heard something cool or you think you know what that Noisy is that I played for you, you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Now I have a few things to tell you guys. First, again, I've been saying this recently on the show. You know, we haven't been playing a lot of ads. Our ad revenue has dropped significantly And that, you know, the ad revenue is actually a big part of the income that the SGU makes. So if you enjoy this show and if you feel like you've gotten something out of listening to this show, then please do consider becoming a patron. We could really use your support. You know, the cash flow that the company has keeps the show going. So please show your patronage. Go to patreon.com/skepticsguide to check out what we have going on. And if you are a patron or a recent patron, I'd really like to thank you for your support. It means a lot to us. We have two things coming up, guys. We have a private show, a private SGU recording that's going to happen at DragonCon. This recording is going to happen at 4:30 p.m. on Sunday. That's 4:30 p.m. on Sunday the what, Steve?
September 3, I believe. Yes.
Sunday, it's September 3.
DragonCon Sunday. That's all you got to say.
It's the American Hotel Atlanta downtown. This is on 160 Ted Turner Drive, Northwest Atlanta, GA 30303. It's 30303. This is the hotel that we've been doing it every year. You can't miss it. It'll be a private show. It'll last at least a couple of hours. You know, have time to hang out and chit chat.
So, you know, actually, it's been a few years since we've been to DragonCon, let alone doing a private show at DragonCon. These are always like among the funnest live shows that we do. So, first of all, if you haven't been to an SGU live show, they're a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun recording them. The audience is always having a blast. We usually rope in a special guest. There's a lot of fun people at DragonCon that we could potentially get on there with us. And, you know, it's just there's a lot more energy, you know, with the live shows. They're a ton of fun. So the SGU live show experience, you know, no one has ever regretted going to an SGU live show. It's always really, really a blast. So if you're going to be at DragonCon, try to carve out some time. Come see us, you know, for that show. And yeah, I'm looking forward to it. This is the first one in several years.
So you will be able to go to theskepticsguide.org, and on that page there'll be two buttons on there. One will be for the Eventbrite for this private show at DragonCon, and the other one will be for the other big show that we have coming up, which is our Nauticon conference happening November 3rd and 4th. Last week I was talking about some of the events that'll be happening, but the quick short is that Andrea Jones-Roy, George Robb, and Brian Wecht will all be joining the SGU crew to entertain you for that Friday and Saturday. There'll be events happening all day on both days, and we'll have nighttime activities as well. But there will be plenty of time to socialize with other people, hang out, and have a really good time. We are down to, I believe, 25 tickets left.
Ooh.
So, wow. Yep. Now is the time to buy, because if you delay, you might not get them, because the tickets, they've been steadily flowing in, as Evan predicted, right? Evan, you said it, and I'm like, yes. I hope you're right. And he was right. We just had a steady flow of tickets coming in. So if you're interested, it's going to be a really good time, guys. This is all about having fun and socializing. We're going to entertain the hell out of you.
Yeah.
You're not going to be sitting there listening to the same old lectures over and over and over again. We're going to do all new stuff. It's all going to be just a lot of fun. So you can go to theskepticsguide.org. You'll see a button there that says Nauticon on it, November 3rd and 4th. Please join us. We promise you'll have a great time.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Do a couple of emails. So we got a massive amount of feedback over the last week on the electric vehicle discussion. It was definitely the most popular segment last week, or at least the one that most people wanted to talk about.
I'd say most notorious.
You think so? There's a couple of – actually, it was all mostly positive. I can't remember any like real pushback other than like a, you know, like nuances here and there. Most people were kind of on board with the whole discussion. But just two things to add to the discussion. One is that – you know, we really have to be thinking not just like a snapshot of where EVs are right now, but also the potential for the future. And so one way to look at that is the internal combustion engine, the technology is improving incrementally, but, you know, we've picked all the low-hanging fruit. It's mostly plateauing in terms of like efficiency and all that. There's not going to be any massive gains in efficiency in the internal combustion engine. But EVs are still on the steep part of the curve. You know, they're still getting, you know, if you include the batteries as well. In 5 years, in 10 years, they're going to be much better than they are today. So that's something else to consider in terms of the whole question. The other thing is, which I can't remember, I think we mentioned before on the show, but I didn't bring it up last week. Increasingly, there's discussion, and some EV manufacturers are moving in the direction of including with their EVs a DC to AC converter, which allows you to use the battery in your car as backup power for your house.
Nice. Mm.
And these batteries are huge. We were talking about the cement thing. About your car battery, if you have like a 300-mile range, which is like the average range now in a US EV, that's like 2 days of backup power.
That's where I thought you were going when you first asked that question.
Yeah, you thought so?
Yeah, because you were like, and I was like, is it your house or is it in your house?
Yeah. No, yeah. It is your house, but it's in your house too. It is the rabbit. So
right, you're living the battery.
But the other thing is, because these cars, the thing is that these cars are basically driving computers, right? And because you really could leverage a lot of the advantages of the EV, you know, technology with having like a computer and software and running everything. It is great. It is fantastic to be able to just program your car to do whatever you want. Imagine if we have like a million EVs plugged into the grid at night, all, you know, plugged into the network, to the grid, as a massive distributed grid storage. You could pull electricity from your EV when electricity prices are high, demand is high, and then recharge it overnight when demand and prices are low. And that could be one further way to stabilize the grid. And so we're doing it. We're producing a ton of massive batteries. There's no reason they should just be sitting there, you know? So I predict this is going to be a thing, you know, where both for personal use and grid use, you know, your car battery will be multi-purpose. Absolutely. Because they're massive, you know? If you wanted to buy like a Powerwall the same size, it'd cost you like $20,000.
Yeah.
Why do that when you could just buy a car?
There you go. Right. Yeah, like might as well.
For like 10,000 more. Yeah.
Could you buy just a car battery?
You can.
I'm sure but
some cars have battery swap options where you can buy a second battery. So I don't know how you would plug that in, but
I think this is what I think. Okay. I like modular technology. Right, I think my desktop computer should be modular to the point where I should be able to hot swap anything.
Yeah.
Imagine.
And I'm surprised you have a Tesla.
Well, I know, I don't think there's an EV that has a modular battery. Imagine.
I just think the Tesla is like the Apple of the EVs.
Yeah,
but like
I agree.
10 times worse.
I agree. But it's wonderful, but I agree. So, imagine, let's say you buy a car. Electric vehicle, and it has 150-mile range as sort of the built-in battery. But it has expansion slots at 30 miles per battery, and you could put them in, take them out. You know, you could get your range up to 350, 400, 450 if you need to. But then you take them out, and you put them in the charger in your garage. You don't have to drive around with them carrying all that weight when you don't need it. Long trip, you throw them in there. You could share them among your vehicles or even, you know, among a group.
Like, or rent them.
Or rent them. Yeah, you go to your car rental or your dealership or whatever, gas station. You pull up. They throw in some extra batteries that are all charged up, ready to go, and you go on your long trip. Then on your way back, you go there, they take them out, and you're good, you know? So, I don't know.
$20, that'd be great.
That I think we somebody should move in that direction, that whole idea of modular batteries. So it would solve a lot of problems if it's cost-effective and practical and all that. But it's an interesting idea. Anyway, second email topic. So as you may or may not know, every Wednesday, Ian, Jay, and I go into the studio, the SGU Studios, supported by all of your kind patronage. And we are doing, Jay and I do a 20-minute, you know, YouTube video on some skeptical topic. And then I record 3 or 4 TikTok videos, which we then publish throughout the week. Although I'm pretty sure that patrons get early access to it, right, Jay? Or is that just the YouTube videos?
Get early access to our YouTube video.
Yeah, our YouTube videos. Yeah, TikTok, you just have to publish it or not publish it. It's an interesting ecosystem, TikTok. You know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
It's
interesting. Yeah. That's kind.
That's one word.
Yeah.
That's very kind.
It's a young audience, which I think is good for us to reach out to a young audience. But, you know, they have their own vibe, which I think we're still learning what the vibe is over at TikTok. And I think, we were having this discussion. We also do a live stream. That's the other thing. Like on Wednesday, we're going to try to really make it consistently at 1 on Wednesday, Eastern time. We start to stream live on TikTok. We chat with people, you know, then we record the YouTube video and we do the TikTok videos all while live streaming. And you get to hear our behind the scenes commentary and again, ask questions, have a conversation. It's a lot of fun. So I want to do is I want to start pulling some of those TikToks into the show occasionally. Like if there's an interesting one I want to talk about. So one of the ones that Ian and Jay suggested to me that I actually did this week, I don't think it's been published yet, is RFK Jr. being interviewed on a TikTok video. And I had to respond to this one. So you could, you know, you could respond to a video that's already published. So like you play like an 8-10 second segment of the video, or you could do the whole thing and sort of comment along, or you could just say, here's a little excerpt, you know, 10 seconds, and then I respond, you know, which is typically what I've been doing. So RFK Jr. was asked about, because, you know, he's running for the Democratic nomination for president. He was asked, what's your plan for dealing with health care? Kara, what do you think he said?
Oh, gosh. Do away with all vaccines?
Good guess.
Sort of. Sort of. Okay. His answer
was... And then everyone will be healthier?
We're going to eliminate all chronic disease.
Oh, good. That's a good plan.
That's his plan.
That's a good
eliminate
plan.
Chronic disease.
It's like the underwear gnomes. It's like, then a miracle happens.
Then
it's like,
a miracle happens. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, what?
That's not a plan. That is an aspiration. And that
right. That's a
not,
fortune cookie.
That is not a realistic aspiration.
No.
But the thing, this is what I think. I think, so what, first of all, it shows an amazing naivete, misunderstanding, disrespect for the medical establishment.
All that.
Like the idea that we're not trying to solve chronic diseases. I mean, he has no idea what's going on. The guy's clueless.
No, we're not trying to solve them because we want to, you know, we want to milk people. Yeah. And
That's what he's
meant. Pharma makes money off sick people.
Yeah. Which is nonsense. The other thing is that this was a dog whistle to the anti-vaxxers. And if you read the comments, they heard it loud and clear. It's like, yes, you're right. And he said, you know, he threw out things like we're having more chronic illnesses than ever. We're having like 80% of our healthcare is chronic illnesses, only 10% in 1960. We need to go back to that where it's only 10% of our healthcare. It's like, you know, you think that might have something to do with the fact that people aren't dying of pneumonia at 40 anymore? Like people are living longer?
Polio.
You think it might have something to do with the fact that we've already – you know, cured a lot of the things that we can't cure. And then what we're left with are the things that are really hard. You know, we've been researching Alzheimer's disease for 30, 40 years, and we still are just now getting to the point where we're seeing some light at the end of the tunnel. This is hard. He's going to just wave a magic wand and cure chronic disease. But again, the dog whistle thing, people understood that to mean, well, chronic illnesses are being caused by environmental exposures like vaccines and other things, and he's going to do away with them. Right. That's what people understood that to mean, you know, his adoring fans, which, of course, is nonsense.
Yeah.
So it is what he said.
That's what I said. Sort of.
Failed.
He did sort of say that.
It
was more of a dog. I think, in my opinion, it was more of a dog whistle. Because, again, if you can read the comments, that's how they took it. That's 100% how they took it. And it's just ridiculous. And my plan is to cure chronic disease. Then everything's good. That's the same plan as the Natural Law Party back in the day. Remember them? Those are basically like the transcendentalists.
Whoa.
That was also their plan for healthcare. We're just going to pray and meditate and cure chronic illness. Man, we're
That's
good.
That's right.
Yeah. Just utter nonsense.
Yeah, just think that you're healthy and you'll be healthy. Great.
He also does this thing, which drives me crazy, that politicians are famous for, but a lot of people do. It's like you throw out a statistic and then you are encouraging a certain implication to be drawn from that statistic, but it's incomplete and you're not really trying to figure out what's going on. So he said, like, Americans spend more money on healthcare than any other, like, wealthy industrialized nation, and we don't get better outcomes. And so it sounds like we're doing something wrong, right? We're doing something profoundly wrong. We're spending 20-30% more than, like, European nations or whatever, and without better outcomes. But it's not like that hasn't been studied. Again, the implication is that we're doing it wrong. But what do you guys think? This is asked and answered. It's been studied multiple times. And there's a very clear answer as to why Americans spend more on healthcare. What do you think it is?
I mean, it's
stupidly expensive prescription drugs.
Yes, that's
it's
it.
It's managed.
Good job.
Yeah,
Bob.
It's because things are more expensive in the United States. Healthcare has a higher sticker price for the same things, not just drugs, but pretty much everything. Mm.
But even
it.
That is not the reason. I mean, that is the downstream.
That's the 90%er. That's the 90%er.
But what I'm saying is the reason for that is complex.
Yes, you're correct.
The reason things are more expensive here is because of
that's the proximate
broken
cause,
system.
But there are deeper causes. Absolutely.
Right, right.
So, like, for example, with your – a lot of it is drug prices. A lot of it is drug prices. And so
but
why
isn't
do we
that, – isn't that because – my understanding is that – these companies, they put the research in and they develop a new drug. And it's very expensive. I get that. But they're trying to recoup their money and make a lot of profit. But they go to other countries. Like, here's what we're going to charge for this expensive med. And you're like, the country's like, we're not going to spend that much money. That's bullshit. And so the prices go up in the United States.
Right.
And they stay relatively low in other countries.
That's exactly correct. That's exactly correct.
But the way you're explaining it is loaded. You're also neglecting to say
that. Oh, I'm loading the crap out of it.
I'm just saying you're neglecting to say that we don't do that
we
here.
We don't do that. That's the flip
yeah,
side.
Yeah, we don't go. No, we're not going to pay that. We
our,
go, sure,
our
lobby
government,
to be able
course,
to pay.
Of course, that's the implication. That we're just like, well, that's what we got to pay.
Like Medicare,
but we don't.
Medicare and Medicaid are not allowed to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies for drug prices. They're not.
Right, that's the problem.
That's
not
the problem.
Allowed
that's a major
to.
Problem.
Other countries are allowed to negotiate with them. So they negotiate low prices, and the pharmaceutical companies make all their profit off of Americans. That's it. That's like most of the problem right there. It has nothing to do with our actual healthcare not working or being wrong or whatever he thinks is going on, vaccines and whatever.
Yeah, he thinks it's like a failure of actually doing doctoring.
Right, right. It's
but
not.
But really, it's a failure of the system of
just,
how.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
And again, you know, there's multiple. There's a complicated problem with complicated answers. I do think that a big thing is that we absolutely need to get universal health care. Right? Like we shouldn't have 10, 12, whatever. What's the number now? I know it was 20 at one point, then it went down with Obamacare, and then it crept back up. But you have something in the teens, I think, million people who don't have health insurance. So
right,
what do
now
they do?
That's,
So they, first of all, they don't get preventive care. And then when they have an acute problem, they go to the emergency room. They get the most expensive possible care.
And they're sicker, and they require more intervention over the lifespan in their shorter lifespan. Yeah, it's horrible.
Exactly. So,
they're more likely to have cancer that's, you know, stage three instead of stage one. Like, that's just across the board that happens.
Yeah. So there are some real problems with our system, but it's not the medicine. It's the,
no,
it
of course
is the
not.
Economics.
It's the access.
It's the, the politics and the economics. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. I have a theme this week. The theme is the oldest. The oldest thing, and this is dealing with living things. Okay, you guys ready? Here we go. Item number one, the oldest extant branch of life is the ctenophores, which go back 700 million years. Item number two, polypodiophyta, a type of fern, is the oldest extant plant genus at 380 million years. Item number three, the record for the slowest evolving vertebrate goes to the elephant shark, which is Calorhynchus millii, which has changed little in 450 million years. Now, I'm just going to give you a couple of points of explanation before you bother to ask. Extant means it's not extinct. It's still living today, right?
We know that.
I'm just, this is for the audience, Bob. Just relax.
Chill, Bob. Chill. That's amazing. I love it.
In none of these am I talking about species, right? So It's
larger groups.
A type of fern. I'm talking about like a major group of ferns,
right?
You know? Or like branch of life. It's not a species. It's a major branch of life, right? And when I say that the elephant shark has changed little, I mean morphologically. So they look the fossilized versions of them look very similar to the extant versions, not genetically. Just to clarify those things before it comes up, okay? Any questions? Mm-hmm. This is a little complicated, so I'm happy to answer any questions. Just out of the gate.
So I'm completely lost already, so don't worry about it.
All right. There they are in the chat. Evan, go first.
So the sea is silent, huh? Fiction. No. I don't know this word. Tenophores. Should I know that?
Tenophores.
Tenophores.
It's a comb jelly.
Yeah.
Huh.
So that helps.
Grape, vanilla, okay. And strawberry. Yeah. Okay. Wow. 700 million years.
Did you just make
years.
Like a jam / jelly joke, Evan?
That's for the audience to decide. I preserve that joke. Which go back 700 million years. 700 million, oh my gosh, that's a long time. That seems too long to me, to tell you the truth. 700 million, really? What are we trying? I'm trying to relate it to something else, to think about what else might be 700 million years old. I'm having a tough time putting my finger on it. All right, the next one, the fern, oldest extant plant genus. Yeah, 380 million years. That seems more correct to me. I thought that's kind of where we are with plants, somewhere around that many years. That's 700 million is old. And then this last one about the elephant shark changed a little in 450 million years. Elephant sharks. Well, elephants are not sharks, so maybe that's the fiction. But, oh boy. I guess the Tenophores one. Gosh, could you be pulling a fast one, though? I mean, that's so extreme that that
always
winds up being the science, right? So therefore what? I have to go with the fern at 380 million years, I suppose? Okay, I'll play that game. Fern, 380 million years, fiction. Total guess.
Okay, Bob.
I think you are trying to pull a fast one here. I think I'm just going to say that it's fairly common knowledge, I think, that sharks just have not changed that much in a long time. I think that's pretty fairly common knowledge. So, but 450 seems like a lot. The number I remember hearing is, 200 million years. Now, would you just double it? It seems a little bit unlikely that you would just double it. Typically, you'd want to go, at least five times more. But I think you want us to just disregard the shark one, because it's like, oh yeah, sharks haven't evolved in a long time, and just like blindly just go with that. Plus, I never even heard of an elephant shark. Heard of a whale shark, but elephant shark? I haven't heard of that one. So that just kind of sweetens the deal. So I'll say that's fiction.
Okay, Jay.
I'm definitely going to say that the shark right out of the gate, I say it's science.
Screw you, Jay.
It's an elephant shark, though.
But it doesn't matter, because I think, from just, general knowledge, from what I understand, like some sharks, if not all of them, just don't change much.
Yes.
Because they're perfect eating machines. You know what I'm saying? Going back to the movie Jaws, they're perfect eating machines. So anyway, so between the first one and the second one, I picked the second one because it has a longer word, which I know I absolutely cannot pronounce. And I'm going to do it right
look
now.
Look at it. Polypodiophyta.
Stop. Let me do it myself.
All right.
Polypodiophyta.
Unless the P is silent, I think you're right.
I can't do it. That one is fiction. I don't like the number 380, and that's it.
And Kara.
So the Tenophores are double the age, basically, of the ferns, is what you're saying here. They are an extant branch of life. So the comb jellies that we see today, what you're saying is evolved. We could trace back their evolution to when they first branched off 700
yeah,
million years
they
ago.
They were comb jellies 700 million years ago.
Yeah, they were still considered comb jellies yeah, then. Right. Whereas the polypodiophyta, which is 380 million years, basically you're saying the same thing,
yeah.
That 380 million years ago, they were the same ferns. They might have changed a little, yeah. But
They were still considered in that group.
Yeah. And then in some ways, you're kind of saying the same thing in the last one, yeah. But differently, yeah. Right? So the elephant shark, Calorhynchus millii? I can't read.
I think millii.
My glasses. Millii. Yes, also kind of branched off or became what we would consider to be that. But you did specify at the beginning that we're not talking about the specific species,
yeah.
Or we are.
No, we're not. Definitely not.
Okay, we're not talking about the species.
Don't survive more than 2 million years, 3 million
right.
Years.
Right.
Yeah, this is all groups. These are other higher taxonomic groups.
a genus and species there, but you're talking about today's species as part of a group that evolved.
So, but yeah, so in this one, I'm just saying, if you look at an elephant shark 450 million years ago and you look at one today, they've changed the least of any other vertebrate over that much time. If you say, how much have they changed over
Of any other vertebrate. Yeah, that's an important point, right? Because obviously that would nullify the tenophore if we weren't talking about vertebrates. They're all science.
There you go.
I can't get
is
away
that your
with
guess?
That.
I'll take that as your guess.
I can't get away with that, can I?
Well, you may be wrong.
I'm happy to take that as your guess. You're guaranteed
no,
to be wrong.
I know I'm wrong. I'm guaranteed to be wrong. I like the tenophores. I like the comb jellies. I think they're our old school friends. Ferns are pretty complex, but they're not that complex. I always thought it was like cycads. Cycads? Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
I think of like the era of the dinosaurs. Maybe that one is okay. Sorry, who picked? Nobody picked the shark.
I did.
Bob did.
I'm gonna go with Bob. I'm gonna go with the shark.
Okay, so you got two for the shark, two for the fern, and none of you picked number one. So we'll start there.
Science.
Uh oh. He sounds happy.
It must be science.
The oldest extant branch of life is the tenophores, which go back 700 million years. Do you guys remember when the Cambrian explosion happened?
Right. Wasn't it 580 million years ago?
500?
Yeah, something in the 500s. Yeah.
Well, something's got to be older than that.
Well, something. But something that's still around today.
Our jellies.
I don't know. Yes.
Well, this one could be goo. Is science. This is science.
Yeah. See, threw me off
freaking
that.
Freaking
old. Totally.
Yeah, this was the gotcha one. I was hoping you were going to say 700. It's before the Cambrian explosion.
Exactly.
No way.
That's what I thought.
But yeah, there are fossilized tenophores, recognizable tenophores that go back 700 million years. So that makes them the oldest. I mean, they basically branched off from all animals right when animals came into existence. You know what I mean? Mm. Pretty much soon after that.
I don't like you guys. Cool. See you later.
Yeah. All right. Polypodiophyta, a type of fern, is the oldest extant plant genus at 300 million years.
380.
Evan and Jay, you think this one is a fiction. Bob and Kara, you think this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
Ooh, yes.
Good job,
Evan. We tried, Bob.
And good
burn
job,
the
Evan.
Fern, yeah.
Yeah, Evan did the psychological approach.
Yes, that's all I had to go with. I mean, you know.
Yeah. So the Polypodiophyta is the most common extant group of ferns today, but they emerged not that long ago. So they did. The 380 is when you go back to all ferns.
Ferns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not,
okay.
Not
and
this.
So they are not that lineage.
Yeah, and there aren't anything that was around 380 million years ago are not extant today. You know, those oldest groups, you know, died out, but you have the modern ferns.
Well, something had to continue the lineage.
Yeah, they just changed enough that they were from a different group. You know?
I see. Okay.
Yeah. It's all about, you know, how long do things endure as a recognizable.
Right, and how do we classify them?
Right. Now, what do you think is the oldest extant plant genus if it's not ferns?
Some kind of moss. Not a moss. A
moss.
Alge.
You are correct.
Oh, it is moss.
Go with it. Go with
okay,
it.
Okay, moss.
Oh,
yeah,
Evan.
Moss. Ooh,
totally.
That count for two
so
wins?
Sure of that. I think so. I think you get a bonus.
You get a win with
moss.
An asterisk.
Oh, I love asterisks.
So I've read different ones, though, which is part of the reason why I made this the fiction, because I couldn't find. The most recent article I see says Takakia, for whatever
Takakia
that's
worth. Takakia Shaka
Khan. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what that Takakia.
Not changed recognizably in 165 million years. Makes it the oldest extant group of plants. You know, again, that is still recognizably the same group that it was in the past. But I've read different things, you know. So Takakia separated from other mosses 390 million years ago. So you could also say that it goes back that far. But they said that they've been pretty stable, you know, over 165 million years. Some sites, however, say the horsetail is the oldest one. Again, giving similar numbers, but I don't know if that's just outdated now.
Nay.
Yeah. All right, this means that the record for the slowest evolving vertebrate goes to the elephant shark, Calorhynchus milii, which has changed little in 450 million years. That is science. Now, interestingly, the elephant shark is not a shark. It's also not even a bony fish. It is a...
cartilaginous?
It is a cartilaginous
well, that's good, Bob.
Fish.
Thank you.
So it's a cartilaginous fish that's not a shark.
Right. It's not a shark.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because sharks are also cartilaginous fish.
Yes, I know. I get that. But this is called...
Right. So it's like a circle or a square is a rectangle, but a rectangle... No. Yeah. Rectangle, square, square is not a rectangle. Yeah.
No, square is a rectangle.
Damn it.
Rectangle
is not a square. Yeah.
But this is, again, morphologically, these things look the same as they did 450 million years ago. And they do look like something out of, you know, the ancient oceans of the earth.
Oh, yeah. Look at that thing. Holy crumbs.
Yeah. They have, they're sometimes called the elephant fish, or the ghost fish is another name. The elephant comes from their snout, you know, basically. And yeah, they're a very, very primitive, you know, morphology of cartilaginous fish. Again, branched off pretty close to where the, you know, the modern fish lines branched off from each other, the cartilaginous and the bony fish lines branched off. And so it provides a lot of insight into that era. Like, what did, you know, the ancestor, you know, to the different two major groups of fish, what did they look like? Hmm. And there are a lot of interesting things. Like, these guys don't have an adaptive immune system, right? That hadn't evolved yet. And they never managed to evolve one over the last 450 million years.
How are they still hanging?
Yeah. Well, they have an immune system. It's just not an adaptive immune system.
Well, right? You would think that...
They're still rocking old school.
They would be at a disadvantage because of that.
And they can't make bone, right? They can't calcify their, you know, their whatever, right, the cartilage to make bone. So they are cartilaginous.
Man, they're weird looking.
Yeah, they're
they
weird
can't
looking.
Get bone cancer.
But they cartilage can't get cartilage cancer.
Yeah, that's true.
So good job, Evan and Jay,
of course.
Yeah, yeah.
You guys don't pair up that often, yeah, yeah. I think.
But when we do.
I know, this is a weird pairing today.
Oh, yeah. Oh, when we do, it's like, you know, Wonder Twin powers activate.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
This week's quote is courtesy of a listener, Cully, from Utah. Thank you for sending this in. It's hard to tell which is worse, the wide diffusion of things that are not true, or the suppression of things that are true. Harriet Martineau, somebody I was not familiar with. Anyone know who Harriet Martineau was?
I do not know.
19th century English social theorist, often seen as the first female sociologist.
Cool.
Born in 1802, she died in 1876.
And this is, somebody could have said this today.
Exactly. That's the point. That's why I really like this quote. Totally. Ahead of her time.
Well, it's also, I think, yes, in a way. She deserves full credit for that. But it's also, I think, a manifestation of the fact that some things just never change.
That's,
you know?
Right. Yep.
It's like we're dealing with, and we know that now as skeptics, like the same things just cycle around over and over and over again. It's never ending. It's a merry-go-round of pseudoscience and nonsense.
I like to say it's human beings being human.
Yeah. But it's good. It's always good to know, though, that even 150 years ago, somebody was around who saw it for what it was. Like, the critical thinking was there. It was
there. Called it out. Yep.
At that time. Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
You got it.
Sure, man.
Steve.
Thanks.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.